thanks to you. Thank you for thinking of me. I thank you. Let us say thank you to all you people out there. I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I came out wrong. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York. It's time once again for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Alex.
It's good to be back.
Welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
And Kyle.
Yes, I'm here. Howdy.
You're here. Okay. It's another Wednesday night, and we're here to talk about technology and hacking and all kinds of other exciting, fun things like that. And we have a lot to talk about this this week, of course. First of all, the big breaking story is that Beto O'Rourke turns out to have been a member of the Cult of the Dead Cow. I can't believe I'm saying these words, but it's true. It's kind of funny. Actually, it's very funny. But I think it's a good thing. It turns out there's a book that's coming out. I don't know how this was kept secret for so long. But members of a group famous for hacktivism, and this is a good hacker group, by the way. Many friends of ours have been to a lot of our conferences. Members of a group famous for hacktivism have come forward for the first time to claim him as one of their own, and he has admitted that yes, in fact, he was a part of this. It's really something. I am never surprised by the fact that certain things are kept secret about politicians until way late in the game. For instance, you know, the governor of Virginia, his yearbook photo being kept secret for such a long time, not that's any comparison to this. This is a badge of honor, being a part of Cult of the Dead Cow. People would actually line up to become members of that group. They were frustrated they were not accepted to become a member of CDC, the other CDC. Is something, it's an accomplishment that, you know, it's reserved for intelligent people that have standards that are not destructive, that are not stupid. And I am impressed. I am duly impressed. Of course, I realize that a lot of America won't be. A lot of America will be pointing fingers and saying, aha, you're a hacker. And that means that you're bad. What do you think, Alex? You think that's going to be the prevailing sentiment?
You know, I've given a lot of thought to this as well. And I think there's two sides to this, you know, if you think about Beto's position. And I think, and frankly, the CDC's position on this and keeping it so secret for so long and feeling the need to keep the secret for so long. Like you said, this should really have been, I think, a badge of honor. I think this is something he should have been upfront about. But when you listen to political strategists and they talk about your vulnerabilities politically, you know, you tend to listen to them because this is something that could technically be a chink in his armor here. And his opponents could capitalize on this, but we haven't seen it yet. We haven't seen people really come down and bring the hammer down on him for being part of a hacker group in the past. In fact, I think that, you know, at least the coverage I've read, the Reuters coverage by Joseph Menn, has been, you know, pretty laudatory and why he was a member of CDC. And if you think about what you just said about CDC, the cult of the dead cow, one of the things that they looked for in members was intelligence and wasn't necessarily all about hacking. It was more about writing. They wanted people to write text files. Remember, this was in the age of BBSs, where way before there was full internet access that was available to people. And so people like Beto and other members of CDC used to write text files that Jason Scott probably has all entirely archived in textfiles.org. And some of these text files are probably why Beto kept this secret for so long, because some of them are a little bit disturbing. You know, and I think we should talk about those,
yeah,
too.
I'm going to go into my Fox News mode here and interrupt you.
Sure.
And ask you if, in fact, this is the kind of presidential candidate that you are looking for to represent this country. These are the words of your Beto O'Rourke here. One day, as I was driving home from work, I noticed two children crossing the street. They were happy, happy to be free from their troubles. This happiness was mine by right. I had earned it in my dreams. As I neared the young ones, I put all my weight on my right foot, keeping the accelerator pedal on the floor until I heard the crashing of the two children on the hood, and then the sharp cry of pain from one of the two. I was so fascinated for a moment that when I had stopped my vehicle, I just sat in a daze, sweet visions filling my head. You're a candidate, Alex. Explain yourself.
15 years old, I have to say that.
This is fun.
Yeah.
I could do this.
For a 15-year-old, I think when he wrote that's pretty damn good writing, uh-huh. I have to say, frankly. And I'd rather have a presidential candidate who dreams up inflicting harm on children rather than a president like we have right now who actually inflicts harm on thousands of children.
Yes. Well, you know, to the people who are passing out now or in shock at hearing those words that actually came from Beto O'Rourke's keyboard, it's called fiction.
Exactly.
And read a Stephen King book. You know, read anything that involves horror or taking on the persona of somebody who is not you, and then go investigate and see if he actually was a person like that. I think you'll find that he was not.
Well, and I think it's these text files and the fact that they're archived and the fact that he was well known to be the psychedelic warlord. That was his hacker handle. From
psychedelic, Alex. So drugs. We're now embracing drugs in presidential candidates and warlord. Wow. Okay. That says all kinds of things as well.
It definitely does. I'd rather have a psychedelic warlord than
opening at Fox because I could do this.
Than a vegan.
It's a head rush. It really is.
It should. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you probably could get some kind of job there.
Don't talk while I'm talking.
Yeah.
I'd just like to say that that was taken out of context, and you have no idea how rotten those little kids are in his story. And I, for one, I'm well aware of how wretched and rotten small children can be.
Okay, so, Mellow Kyle, this is a combative talk show. You need to shout and interrupt people.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would like to interject and comment. I can't do that seriously. I just want to say
that's a lot harder.
It's been said and pointed out before, but just to add to the discussion a little bit, I think really what this says is it's more that he is a younger candidate than really the proclivities of the group necessarily. I mean, for us, maybe it lands as a cool thing, and maybe it's scary to some people in the country. But given how much we depend, and this goes to other conversations we've had in the last couple of weeks, but given how much technology, how pervasive it is, and how much we depend on it, I would like someone who is young enough to understand the technology and even have had the opportunity to participate in a hacking group such as this, given the fact that most often our candidates' only affiliation with a group would be like the Civilian Conservation Corps or the other CCC, you know, because they're ancient. And this, I think, should be looked at as a generational milestone, that we're in an era where young candidates like this can represent the entire country.
Yeah, and building on that, I really want to see how this plays out. You know, Beto raised, I think it was $6.1 million in 24 hours, beating even Bernie Sanders when it came to fundraising. You know, that means that right now he's got a lot of sticking power. He's going to be in this race for quite a while. And whether his fellow Democrats attack him on this basis and the basis of his writing, well, that remains to be seen. We're going to see that as a primary shakeout. And I think we're all going to be very interested in how this is weaponized or not weaponized in during the primaries as they play out. The other thing that I think is interesting here, too, is that it was kept such a secret for so long by so many people, and this almost seemed like an outing, you know, like he was outed as a former hacker.
It's weird. It happened right after the campaign was announced.
Exactly. It came out of there. And I don't know if you know this, but the reporter, Joseph Menn, he was at Hope this year as well. In fact, he came up to me after I gave my talk on cyber squatting on the Hope campaign. And we've been in touch since Hope, actually. And then when I saw him publish this article, I said, wait a second, is that the same guy?
And Beto O'Rourke, no, that was at Hope as well. In fact, 1997 is one of the years that they're referring to.
That's the second.
It's where a panel of CDC members occurred. So you can look at that panel. It's on channel 2600 on YouTube and watch. You won't see Beto O'Rourke, I don't think, on that particular panel. But there might be some kind of reference because they're talking about their membership, what the group is all about. And 1997 is when he was a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember actually from the first Hope, 1994, going home with a whole bunch of Cult of the Dead Cow stickers that I put all over my notebooks. I mean, it's amazing.
You didn't put them on. They put them on your notebooks. That's how they operate. They put stickers all over you.
Yeah, actually, we had some similar stickers placed on our Club Mate vending refrigeration machines.
You find them in the weirdest places.
Yeah, and we considered it. We basically had to protect it. We considered it like a blessing more than anything else. My only other memory, or my memory specifically of that group, is at, I believe, Hope number 6, Cult of the Dead Cow did a presentation on off-the-record encrypted communications for, I believe, AIM, and in particular, the client Pigeon, which is actually still maintained to this day, surprisingly. But I remember they did a presentation on basically a module that they had developed for that particular chat client that would allow you to do off-the-record and anonymous and otherwise encrypted communication.
They have done some of the most intelligent panels, I think, of any organization. And I kind of shy away from hacker groups because it tends to bring out the worst in people. Not in this case. CDC has always been intelligent. So if any hacker group is going to lay claim to a presidential candidate, let it be CDC. I'm quite happy about this. And the way Beto O'Rourke owned up to it immediately, just like he owned up to other things from his past as well, that says something too. And that's something I think people should weigh when considering, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Well, if you can not dance around the issue and confront it directly. The only thing I have a problem with is he says he's not proud of those days. I would be proud of those days. I'd be proud of what you wrote because you wrote fiction as a kid. And yeah. That's more than most kids do.
Sorry, he's been way too apologetic just in the last like week in general. But I think you should, we shouldn't have like campaigning be an apology tour for who you are. It should be about getting to know who you are. And that, I think, is getting lost in all this, like, you know, hair splitting over different, you know, gaffes or statements or life circumstances or things he's done or encountered in his life.
And I'd like to know, because I'm not aware of a procedure where you lose your membership in CDC. Is he still a member of CDC? He might still be. In fact, you know, these things lie fallow for a while. He might still be the treasurer for all we know. We have to check into these things. So if anyone has information on that, maybe he could encompass it into his campaign somehow. It would be a good thing.
You know, another thing that's been mentioned, I think, time and again when it comes to Beto and his hacker days is that, you know, he takes certain positions politically now that do seem to jive with the hacker community and others that don't. And some are, you know, more libertarian than we would otherwise think. But if you think back, I mean, I say this all the time when we're at dinner, not necessarily, and oftentimes on this show, but my own political views were shaped very much by what we did back in the 90s as hackers. And, you know, philosophically, it defines you as a person. And if you think back to the 90s, when, you know, the term, quote unquote, cyberspace was just being bandied about, and you had, you know, all these manifestos about how information wants to be free. This was really a very anti-regulation time. It was very laissez-faire. It was, this is a space that is beyond borders, that is beyond recognition when it comes to governments, and it should be very, very hands-off. That sort of lends itself to a very anti-regulation philosophy or framework, and that's what we've seen, I think, with Beto, and not to mention he comes from Texas, so which is another very kind of, you know, libertarian style state in a lot of respects, much more libertarian than, you know, let's say, you know, Massachusetts or New York. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that we can measure his political stance on issues now by who he was 25, 30 years ago. And I think this is exactly what Kyle was saying, and I'm just building on that now. And whether we see other candidates trying to use this past against him or political action committees trying to use his past against him, I think is going to be very interesting to a lot of members in our community, myself included, who may have further designs in life to do similar things.
You know, I, as an exercise for the listener, explore the history of this guy's childhood. Look at the kind of kid he was, and then go and look at the kind of kid Mike Pence was. Compare the two. Which one would you rather hang out with? Which one do you think has more of a future as an individual? And your answer may vary, but I think the person who makes some mistakes, experiments with various things, and reaches out a lot, I think that's the person that will actually be more mature.
And somebody who was interested in actually learning. I mean, some of the quotes you see in the Reuters article itself are about how he found it so great to be part of this community of smart people where they were interested in learning how the world worked, learning how things like the telephone system worked. I mean, this is what we talk about every week.
Uh-huh.
It's that curiosity that you have as a child. If you maintain that childlike attitude into adulthood, you know, you're somebody who's going to be a lifelong learner. That's the exact opposite of what we have in the White House right now.
We have gotten not a lot. I'll give the media credit, not a lot, but some inquiries as to whether or not Beto O'Rourke was a subscriber to 2600. And we will never, it doesn't matter what you entice us with, we will never give out that information. So was he a reader? Well, you can speculate on that, but we are certainly not going to tell people who reads our magazine and who does not. Even if you know, the whole Trump family is reading the magazine, we're not going to reveal that information. So stop asking.
I just wanted to add that, you know, I wouldn't take our comments here as necessarily any kind of particular endorsement. And I feel kind of pretty confident, or I feel very strongly that about what you said about him maybe not having some of the policies that you agree with. I certainly don't agree with him on everything, and I'm not endorsing him at all.
That's a good thing, though.
But I think that it's of concern or of interest to our community and how this is characterized, like also what you both were saying going forward, how this is used, how it's characterized. It will be interesting, and it also is instructive about some of his policies. This will be in the back of our minds. This will be in the back of a lot of people's minds when things like, FCC policy, neutrality policy, whatever it is, next generation networking or whatever computing or privacy issue comes up, we'll want to know perhaps where he fits and why and how he has evolved, because people do change.
The fact that he even knows about these things, I think, is well ahead of most other candidates.
It might be that makes him very well suited for the kind of future we're going to be experiencing. And I think that goes back to the age thing I was commenting on.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to build again on what Kyle was saying, you know, my comments, as laudatory as they were about Beto and his past, or really about his past, not his present, certainly not endorsing him as a candidate, not yet. But, you know, look, everything is going to be weighed and measured as things unfold. And, you know, let's see how this progresses. It's going to be rather interesting.
Beto O'Rourke was a misfit teen in El Paso, Texas in the 1980s when he decided to seek out bulletin board systems. Those are the online discussion forums we talk about a lot on this show. At the time, they were the best electronic means for connecting people outside the local school, church, and neighborhood. When Dad bought an Apple IIe and a 300-baud modem and I started to get on boards, bulletin boards, it was the Facebook of its day. It just wanted to be part of a community. O'Rourke soon started his own board, Taco Land, which was freewheeling and largely about punk music. We should ask Jason Scott if he has any BBS printouts of Taco Land, or if anyone out there has printouts of Taco Land. We'd like to see them. Email us, oth@2600.com. This was The Counterculture, Maximum Rock and Roll, the magazine. We were a part of that as well. Buying records by catalog. You couldn't find it at record stores. You know, the more I hear, the more I like, because this guy gets it. He's part of that culture, and it's such a valuable, important part of everyone's culture, I think. He then connected with another young hacker in the more conservative Texas city of Lubbock, who ran a bulletin board called Demon Roach Underground, known online as Swamp Rat. Kevin Wheeler had recently moved from a university town in Ohio and was having problems adjusting to life in Texas. And like O'Rourke, Wheeler said he was hunting for video games that had been cracked or stripped from digital rights protection so that he could play them for free on his Apple. Every kid was doing this. Also, like O'Rourke, Wheeler wanted to find other teens who enjoyed the same things and to write and share funny and profane stories that their parents and conservative neighbors wouldn't appreciate. It was a good-natured resistance to the repressive humdrum around them, a sort of footloose for those just discovering the new world of computers. So, yeah, that's what we're looking at right now. Very, very interesting. Did not see this coming.
Yeah, let's see how this plays out. I mean, you know, it's incredibly fascinating to learn that, you know, Beto O'Rourke was a where's kitty, basically.
It is so interesting that this club, it is that club in particular, makes sense. It's fitting, but it's so interesting given how few large clubs and organizations there are in the U.S. Versus other parts of the world we've talked about before. It's pretty poetic and kind of cool to have others acknowledge and to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have other stories to read as well, they're kind of interesting. They're kind of monumental. Did you hear about what happened with MySpace? They accidentally deleted everything uploaded before 2016. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that we've been warning people about. But apparently, if you have music that has been on MySpace more than a couple of years old, it's no longer there. As a result of a server migration project, any photos, videos, and audio files you uploaded more than 3 years ago may no longer be available on or from MySpace. We apologize for the inconvenience and suggest that you retain your backup copies. Wow, nice way they kind of transfer the blame over. But you know what? They're not wrong. You should have backup copies. You should not be depending on any cloud-based service to store your material. You should always have a local copy, because this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. We've been warning people about this for so long, and companies go out of business, people make mistakes, and people lose all sorts of things they should never lose.
Yeah, I mean, think about this in the context of where people store their photos, right? I mean, what if Google Photos just decided to, you know, disband, or you know, it became too burdensome for them to continue to store all these, you know, terabytes of photos that people are uploading continuously all the time, and just one day announced, well, sorry, it's all gone. All those memories of you and your children for the last decade and a half, they're just poof, they're gone. And you didn't back up your phone locally or all those photos? Oh, sorry. But I mean, the long and the short of it here too is, yeah, again, this is something we've been telling people many, many, many times, but I don't think there's really going to be any major repercussions here for MySpace. I don't know if they made any representations or warranties.
I didn't even know they were still around.
I know. Well, I knew they were around because they've been pretty popular as a music sharing site, or a place where you can find new music, and artists use this to get their new music
MySpace?
Out.
MySpace?
Yeah,
All right.
It's kind of transitioned over.
It's after Justin Timberlake bought it and it turned into a music sharing or promotion platform. But I believe his pop stardom was supposed to be the infusion of culture to a platform that was really waning in popularity and usefulness. It's sad, I think, and my heart goes out to whomever was responsible for doing this migration. And frankly, where are their backups, firstly? And secondly, for a platform that has turned into something that is primarily focused on music, why did you lose people's music?
Exactly. Yes.
Well,
I didn't know that's what they were mostly designed to do now. But if you're gonna do that, protect it.
It's like if SoundCloud was like, "Oops, sorry," you know, all the recordings and albums and you know links you wanted to share. Well, we can't really help you with that, and we don't have backups because it's not our department.
That could happen too. So if you're on SoundCloud, keep backups somewhere else as well.
There are some theories about why this perhaps happened, and maybe it has to do with operational expenditures. Or OPEX, that you know the platform isn't bringing in lots of money, it isn't bringing in lots of visitors, it's not selling tremendous amounts of ads, but it's extraordinarily expensive to keep all these terabytes running. And if you just get rid of them, your OPEX goes down and your cash influx all of a sudden becomes positive.
I'm not going to go...
It's a theory.
I totally hear that. I'm not going to go so far as to say that it was like intentional. It's convenient maybe in yes. that light, like if you look at it that way, but... I would say that definitely that may have been the impetus to reconfigure and otherwise meddle with the infrastructure. In other words, you've got racks and racks and racks of stuff that's basically a whole lot of overhead with power, data and uplinks, maintenance, repairing RAIDs or whatever the heck is involved in the operational side. So they may have been trying to move or consolidate stuff to less racks, to different sites where the bandwidth or the power is more affordable. That could be across country, could be across town. It could even be a cloud like host provider a la AWS. And all those usual suspects. So wherever this broke in the planning, it's both, I think, convenient going forward in the ways you described, but also quite disruptive. They may have been in good faith trying to make their business plan more workable. And this is a casualty of that process.
Well, I do think MySpace might deserve some credit for protecting its users' data by deleting it and not sharing it with anybody else. Unlike Facebook, unlike many other social media platforms, you're safe on MySpace. Nobody's going to see your material.
Yeah, you won't be shamed for using their platform.
Oh no, you'll be shamed. You'll definitely be shamed. But
it'll be harder.
Nobody's going to see it anymore. So I don't know. Where do they go from here? How do you? What does Justin think about his purchase now? How are they going to market that to people?
I have no clue. I don't even know. It may have changed hands even further. But that was the last I had heard of what was going on when a lot of these sort of disintegrating Web 2.0 platforms needed to hit the chopping block.
Well, I'll tell you, my prediction here is that inevitably there will be lawsuits that will be filed against MySpace for the deletion of this particular data.
What kind of lawsuit? It's free. You don't pay for it. So what kind of lawsuit could you possibly file?
Well, somebody will come up with some theory of how they're damaged by this. I guarantee you that there are scores of class action plaintiff's lawyers right now going through all the terms of services, the historical terms of service, the terms of use, any kind of representations or warranties about the storage of data or the mechanism they use to protect their data, things like that. They're going to try to hang their hat on that, file a class action, probably over in California state court somewhere.
Yeah, but we were just talking about BBSs that Beto O'Rourke might have called into back in the 80s or 90s. And those are free. Now, he was running aboard Taco Land. What if he decided to take down Taco Land? Would we be able to sue Beto O'Rourke for deleting our private material that was in our account on his BBS? How is MySpace that different?
Well, the difference now is that there's a lot of money to be made by these particular lawsuits, not necessarily in litigating them to the end of a trial and a jury verdict, but litigating them to encourage settlement. If you get a class action certified by a federal judge, that's basically money in the bank for the plaintiff's lawyers that would be bringing these particular actions. They're going to try to find class representatives, maybe some artists who lost their recordings, their materials that detrimentally relied, that's the magic word, detrimental reliance here, on MySpace recording and maintaining and storing these particular files for a number of years. Let's say they relied on them for a decade and came to rely on them. Now, all of a sudden, poof, it's gone. They lost all of this investment in their recordings, and now they're going to sue for millions and millions of dollars worth of damages. But not just them. All these other artists are going to join into that class action. You get that class certified, the lawyers are going to have a pig's breakfast on that settlement.
I would add, and what comes to mind for me is this is similar to like at-will employment or something, and I'll tell you why. I think that there is a lot of similarity, but the distinctions here are that A, the types of people that were using that system were probably, or you might argue, are hobbyists, and perhaps not their understanding of equipment failure might be a bit more understanding, and their expectation of things lasting forever, or it being like a permanent home for different files or other things, may have been a lot more tempered than the kinds of consumers that are using the platforms we're talking about in the modern sense, like MySpace. Their expectation that it will work in a certain way, and their lack of skill, maybe them being not of the hobbyist persuasion, maybe they have more consumer rights from that perspective. And I would add to that, and really that sort of technical thing that is maybe a little bit like in a legal term of distinction, would be that perhaps the BBS days would have articulated the use of that system as something that is as is or without warranty, whereas these systems are giving you pages and pages of legal documentation saying that, yeah, it will work, but this is how we're going to protect ourselves if it doesn't, but it still ought to work this way. People were very upfront with BBSs being as is or software, like software programs that, you know, do not warrant you using it. It's especially the case with privacy software and other things where you basically are using it knowing that it very well may fail and you have zero repercussion or recourse.
I think you are absolutely right, Kyle. There's a huge difference in expectations of the users of BBSs back in the 90s where, you know, these things are running off of a single phone line and a 10 meg hard drive, if there even was a 10 meg hard drive.
You're not going to sue a 13-year-old kid, though. Well, some of us would, but...
Well, yeah. And the resources of that kid to maintain it are like what? You know, he's going to go get another paper out to buy a hard drive?
Right. If necessary, yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly right. And we live in this era of very, very large damages coming from class action lawsuits, and people's expectations are totally different now. I think you're completely right in every single thing that you said there.
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if and when these lawsuits do happen, the names of the bands that claim they were destroyed because they put all of their music onto MySpace and no place else. I just think it's going to look kind of ridiculous.
Well, think about that from a publicity perspective. If you were that band who had, you know, a minor following, let's say somewhere in the Southwest or something like that, and all of a sudden you're the named class representative in this lawsuit against Twitter.
Yeah, but you're not famous for your music then. You're just famous for your litigation.
But you know, the unintentional but foreseeable consequences that your music then gets out to the world.
Does it really get out to the world? Or
I don't know. It's still going to suck.
Uh-huh.
That's when you change your band name to like the Angry Litigants or something. Like
exactly. That'd be great.
Or Swamp Litigants.
If the Angry Litigants lost all their music, that might be the perfect lawsuit.
But, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah, I completely agree again.
Let's move to Florida.
No,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that the way it sounded. No, there's a story in Florida that I'd like to move to. And I just want to read this because of the way it reads. It's from mycbs4.com, which tells you right away all kinds of things. It's a story about a Florida teen whose phone was hacked. Many iPhone users have received a notification saying you need to change your Apple ID. And most of us change it without a second thought. But for Lisa Simmons from Dunalion? Okay. Her teenage daughter had no idea that notification, was from a hacker. She says her daughter didn't notice it immediately until her phone started acting strange. She would say, "My battery life was 4 hours. I can't connect to the network. I think there is something wrong with Sprint." Okay, none of those things are necessarily abnormal. There's always been something wrong with Sprint. Battery life sucks, and networks I'm never able to be connected to. But I don't know what the big deal is. It wasn't until her daughter tried to FaceTime her friend when she knew something was horribly wrong. And not because she was using FaceTime. That would be a clue for me. She said, "He's on my phone. He's on my phone. He's on my phone." I said... "Calm down. Tell mom what's going on." She says the friend received several FaceTime calls from her, but when she answered, it wasn't her. It was Laura from the Black Lodge in Twin Peaks. No. But, you know, if David Lynch got a hold of this, I think we could get a good story out of it. Now, her friend says, "I answered one of them. It was a grown man sitting behind a computer monitor." And that's when the friend hung up. So she was never able to pursue that story and find out what the rest of what was going on there. Someone says Apple helped her change all her passwords, but the family still felt unsafe. Increased battery drainage with phones doing things you're not expecting. Yeah, that's a sign that something is compromised, according to Matt Gockel, Gainesville Police Department's digital forensics detective. And that's a guy you want to get drunk in a bar, really. That's you'll get all kinds of stories. He says hackers can get information from your phone fairly easily when you're on a public Wi-Fi network. Not necessarily as easy as that. You have to do a couple of things. Now, using a public Wi-Fi network in and of itself is not where the hazard is.
Right. I mean, and this was an Apple ID, so she was on an iPhone, which are, you know, they're pretty damn secure, right? You know, it just, this story just seems so poorly thought out and so poorly written, and capitalizing on this fear of hackers, you know, that we've been seeing at least for the last 35 years, probably. What this story says to me is a hell of a lot less about the hack itself and more about the dearth of quality local news stories coming out these days and the slashing of budgets of these particular local stations where they're churning out crap like this. You know, that just seems completely half-baked, where you're getting one side of the story of a teenager who's complaining about, you know, her battery draining, and then quotes from a police officer who probably, you know, look, I'm generally in favor of law enforcement and what they do, and you know, they all do great work and whatnot, but maybe not the world's foremost authority on 0 days when it comes to iOS.
Well, the story's not finished yet, so...
It goes on. Great.
He says hackers can get information from your phone fairly easily when you're on a public Wi-Fi network. When you connect to a public Wi-Fi, you are putting yourself at risk for someone else who is connected to the network who can actually see what you are doing. Well, it's not true. I mean, have to gain access through either somehow getting your ID, getting you to change it, or you know, a number of other ways, but it's not because they're using a public Wi-Fi network.
No, not necessarily. I mean, it depends upon, you know, I think what he's getting at there is that people can be packet sniffing, but you know, that's why you have SSL certificates and you have encrypted connections to the sites that you're going to. I mean, it seems very rudimentary for him.
It's an oversimplification of an attack vector that could yield specific login and credential and so on.
And but dated as well. This is a very dated and simplistic view, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The same thing can happen on a private Wi-Fi network as well, if they gain access to it.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I read recently, the devices are getting so secure that it's really routers and those access points that are more vulnerable. Stuff that's not maintained, stuff that's not updated. You can take that for worth a grain of salt, but it is more likely that you'll do something like click on something or otherwise be duped by email scams and stuff like that than being a victim of somebody who's monitoring a vulnerable switch or router in a public setting that has Wi-Fi.
The Gainesville Police Department's digital forensic detective suggests using complex passwords, not repeat passwords for every website. Always a good idea. If you do that, when you get one account hacked, the rest of your accounts are hacked. Doesn't take much to figure that out. It's got nothing to do with the kind of network you connect on, though. As for the Simmons family, Dunnelton police say this is still a very active investigation and hope they can track down this potential hacker. I am not going to stop until this situation is resolved and enough people know this is possible. That's Lisa Simmons saying that, the kid's mom. So she's going to be relentless in figuring out what's going on, but... you won't find it in this story, though.
So that was the mother saying that, not the police.
Oh, no, okay. They're not as relentless. No.
Okay, because I was going to say, if they're going to devote a significant amount of resources to this one particular crazy case, I mean, I imagine there's more pressing things going on in Gainesville. But, you know, at least we now know that this particular digital forensics detective, I guess his name is, in Gainesville, has a firm grasp of the obvious when it comes to password maintenance. That's good to know.
Here's another story, more local in nature, also revolving around some things that we talk about concerning technology. It's a group of frustrated residents. They're suing their landlord in their Hell's Kitchen apartment building because they don't want to use an app to get into their building. They just want keys. Tenants used to use Latch on their, they need to use Latch on their smartphones to get into the West 45th Street building. Now we all know where it is. Here's a quote from artist Mary Beth McKenzie. She's 72 years old. She's lived in the building for nearly five decades. We just want a key. We've always had a key. Her 93-year-old husband doesn't even have a smartphone and has become a shut-in because of the new system. He cannot use a cell phone. So for him, it's really important to have a key. Latch is used in at least 1,000 apartment buildings across the city, and many newer tenants of the 45th Street building don't mind using the app to access the building lobby, elevator, and mailboxes. It works so well, said Anna Sambeo, a tenant of just 1 month. I don't have any concerns. But the lawyer representing the residents who filed the suit against the landlord says the app is a harassment tactic to force out rent-regulated tenants. Interesting. It's an attempt to surveil the tenants by forcing them to use an electronic key system that includes GPS functions that track their whereabouts and require them to provide sensitive, conditional personal information to use the system. That's according to the lawyer. What do you think, Alex? You think there's some merit in that?
I do. I think this lawsuit actually has legs. I mean, I think it is about fundamental right, the fundamental right of access to your apartment and giving you essentially what is the equivalent of a key. I mean, when you have a lease, the landlord has to give you access to that particular apartment. Generally, what we've known for literally centuries is that involves a key, right? And a landlord cannot monitor when you enter and exit that particular apartment. This is all done anonymously. If you have to use an app for this particular type of entrance and exit, it becomes very problematic. And I think the lawyer is absolutely right that this could become a harassment tactic that is designed to push out the elderly who may be in rent-regulated apartments. You know, they're either rent-controlled apartments or they are rent-stabilized apartments. And let me tell you this, if you're in a rent-controlled apartment, that is an extraordinarily valuable commodity in New York. If you're in a rent-stabilized apartment, not as valuable as rent-controlled, but extraordinarily valuable as well, to the tune of literally about $500,000. If that owner of that building, I don't know how many units are in this particular building, but if the owner of this particular building wants to sell that building, let's say to a commercial real estate developer that wants to raise the building and knock them out, the cost of buying out these tenants is going to be factored into that particular sale price. And the landlord will be able to get a greater economic benefit to himself, the owner of that building, if he has less rent-regulated tenants in there. Putting in a system that harasses the elderly like this and causes them to become shut-ins could very well have the intentional consequence of forcing them out. And if you force out, let's say, 10 tenants, that's a $5 million windfall for you. It's worth a shot if you are a building owner.
It's an interesting twist that this is being used as a means to get rent-controlled people out. But I think this is something that we will see even in buildings that don't have that, because people are so eager to embrace technology blindly and say, wow, this is so much more convenient than handing out keys. We have apps and we can change when necessary. If somebody moves out, we simply turn that account off. But there's also significant potential for control of a negative sort. People can be locked out as punishment for one offense or another, but also when there's a blackout or when phones are lost or when networks go down, you can't get into your building. Why would you ever agree to not have a key? It boggles the mind.
Yeah, I think it should. I hope they win. I hope they just eat their lunch with this case. My first question, I think, is just how many tenants in this building? If it was just a couple, I would lean more towards theory that Alex put forth. But if it is a large number of people in a building, I could see there being a possible case for lowering the overhead, a la embracing a system like this, where you basically don't have to provide a whole bunch of metal keys to everyone. But I also don't agree with that. I mean, I think exactly what you just said was spot on, that yeah, this maybe you know, more cost effective from a management perspective, and more dynamic and flexible for different circumstances. But the case for emergency situations, as well as a vulnerability, I think you could argue that though this may be more convenient and more affordable, it's probably less safe. I mean, the technical means to infiltrate a building like this, especially with like commercial commodity type access control, which this is probably one of those types of products, like from a hardware store. It's probably not got layers of protection or anything you might expect in an industrial setting, or something that's classified or rated for more security. I would argue that, and I would suspect people could make the case that this just basically opens up more vulnerabilities and prevents people, like you said, in an emergency situation. And why it couldn't have both, perhaps the option of using an app or an electronic means, but not going away entirely from a keyed backup. I think that would be a more fair introduction of something like this.
Sure. Requiring people to have a smartphone is unfair. Even requiring people to have a phone line, period. You know, those buildings where you have to dial somebody's apartment and then it calls a phone number. Well, you know, the possibility that somebody didn't have a phone line or didn't want their phone number touch-toned out for all to hear in the street, that was a valid concern when these systems were introduced back in the 90s. This is equally as much of a concern.
Think about forwarding too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it goes to a number and then that number gets touch tones sent back to open a gate, if that number is forwarded somehow or messed with in some of those old legacy systems, you right there have a vulnerability that isn't really breaching anything, unless you know you're getting into the attributes of changing a forward. But if that's accidentally done or done, you know, from that person, the premise, you know, how would you say they violated anything?
Uh-huh.
Or if it was misconfigured or maybe they had a super or somebody doing maintenance that then was compromised in some way, and it wasn't any of the people living there, that it wasn't their fault at all. There's
Again,
many
it's,
avenues.
It's great to play with new technology, and sometimes it'll be extremely convenient for some people, but to blindly jump into it and to make it the only way, it's almost always a mistake, and we have to remember to hold on to those older systems as well, as they serve to be a really important backup. Hey, I found an editorial on thehill.com. I want to read a little bit of it because it's a topic that I think we should discuss. As big tech censorship of conservatives becomes even more flagrant and overt, the old arguments about protecting the sanctity of the modern public square are now invalid. Our right to freely engage in public discourse through speech is under sustained attack, necessitating a vigorous defense against the major social media and internet platforms. I certainly had my suspicions confirmed when Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, accidentally censored a post I made regarding the Jussie Smollett hoax, which consequently led to me hearing from hundreds of my followers about how they've been having problems seeing, liking, or being able to interact with my posts. Many of them even claim that they've had to repeatedly refollow me, as Instagram keeps unfollowing me on their accounts. While nothing about big tech censorship of conservatives truly surprises me anymore, it's still chilling to see the proof for yourself. Of course, that editorial coming from the son of our president, Donald Trump Jr., who joins many conservatives in claiming that there is some kind of discrimination occurring on social media platforms against conservatives. Alex, what do you think?
I mean, you know, this is, I think, a perennial issue that comes up with these conservatives. They're always feeling aggrieved here. I think this lends itself to also a dual discussion here of this lawsuit that Devin Nunes filed against Twitter as well, because this is part and parcel of this. Is that
what I think? Okay, I see nothing but conservative viewpoints on Twitter, certainly on Facebook, if I ever look at Facebook, and I imagine on Instagram as well. So what are they complaining about?
Well, it's this feeling of victimization. I think they feel as if, you know, they're urinating in the wind, right? That, you know, their viewpoint isn't carrying the day, so therefore there must be something wrong with the platform that's not getting the message out there, right? It has nothing to do with the invalidity or the idiocy of their particular arguments. It must be that somebody is conspiring against them to prevent this from actually getting out to the masses, right? I mean, that's part of where all of this is coming from. But look, you know, other people, perhaps people in this room as well, have complained about certain platforms that, you know.
Oh, you're looking at me. Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that seem like, you know, there's some kind of something going on with an algorithm that's preventing the word from getting out. And look.
Well, I can tell you, you know, if you tweet something and three people retweet it and you have, 10,000 followers, something's wrong because someone else tweets the same thing and they get, you know, 100,000 retweets. Yeah, you're not in the algorithm somehow. And it's impossible to talk to Twitter. It's impossible to talk to Facebook. It's impossible to talk to Instagram. There is a problem here, but it's not directed against somebody politically. It's directed against individuals, period.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's a problem, frankly, with the platforms themselves. Mm-hmm. And some things are amplified and some things aren't. And it goes back to what we talked about in 2016 ahead of the election, that all of these platforms are designed to give you and feed you more of what you like. It's about stimulating those areas of the brain that are interested in pleasure. It's a pleasure-seeking platform. So it creates this echo chamber, and you don't get hit with ideas that are different and interesting to you. And you know, you're not going to have a dialectic on these particular types of platforms. They're designed just to feed you more of what you like, not to be a platform of debate or a dialectic on the electoral college. You know, none of this is what they had in mind. They have in mind selling ads and mining data and figuring out your psychology, the intricacies of your psychology, so that they can sell that to advertisers who will better know how to market to you. You know, the people who are complaining about this and feeling entirely victimized because of their political persuasion, I think, are missing the entire point of these particular platforms themselves.
I get what you're saying. I agree with a lot of it. A couple things we were just talking about. I thought, you know, slow down. I mean, just not a week or two ago, we were talking about the conservative Yelp. I mean, I thought they just make their own, you know, hate Twitter or whatever platform of the day they need. They just go ahead and spin up their own copy, and they're happy to just be left to their devices over there. Or was that... maybe that was a white supremacist. Okay, I get them confused sometimes anymore. But the other thing I was thinking is actually one point you made, I would push a little bit back on that engagement is really the rule of the day. I've read a couple things about this, and it's not necessarily always that those platforms are wanting to cozy you up to people that you only agree with. It's very often the case they're channeling stuff that'll really anchor you so that you engage with trolls and do
True.
That kind of thing. So
I agree.
Engagement can be a funny thing. It's not necessarily that you're only going to get served good stuff. You may get a whole lot of good and then a dump of bad to get you to post more stuff and cause other people to rage. And then that rage continues to serve ads and so on and so forth.
Oh my God. While we're talking, I've received a Donald Trump tweet on my phone. It just shows a video of him talking to a massive amount of people. It's a propaganda video.
Yeah, he's at the tank farm
he's
president.
At a tank farm. See, we all know this. It's got 118,000 views, almost 3,000 retweets, almost 10,000 likes. This all happened just now. How are these people complaining that their message isn't getting out? Nothing but their message is getting out, and it's really, really annoying. You know, other people don't have the same kind of chance. Okay, you know, you're talking about our piddling complaints. You look at somebody like Jared Kushner, who has never even tweeted, and his Twitter account instantly verified and legitimate. We've been trying this for years. 2600, nope, you're not valid. My account, not valid. Hacker Radio Show, not valid. Hope Conference, not valid. It's ridiculous. That is, you know, definitely favoring one thing over another. If you are a secretary who works in the White House, yeah, you're legitimate. You're considered. And the reason this is important is because on Twitter, you can weed out everybody who is not listed as verified. So you don't even hear the, you know, whenever I look at my my Twitter screen, it shows me the people who have talked since I looked last. And I have it in time order. Not the best tweets first. If you do that, you'll only see the celebrities, but in actual chronological order. And every time I do that, I only see the verified people. I don't see anybody who is not verified. And according to, if I don't look at it for, say, 15 hours, I only see celebrities saying something, and everybody else that I follow who is not a verified celebrity person has said nothing. And I know that's not the case, but that is how it's portrayed. And I'm sure that's how we as unverified people and entities are also portrayed. It just keeps going on. Do you know on Twitter, for instance, because we are called 2600, we're not allowed to have a hashtag. You can't have a hashtag that's a number. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes some sense. Number one, number two, you don't want that to be a hashtag. But number 2600, please. The letter A can be a hashtag. Single digit letters are okay, but not numbers of any sort. Instagram, we want to get an Instagram account. We're not allowed to. We're not allowed to use our name. We have to call ourselves something else, even though there are other accounts that are all numbers. No, we won't let you do it. So things like this is what people are fighting about. It's not about ideology. It's not about whether a conservative or liberal. It's just about how individuals are made to dance to the tune of whatever these social media masters dictate.
Well, it goes, you know, full circle back to what we were talking about initially with respect to MySpace. You cannot rely on these particular platforms. And people have come to rely on Twitter to become their official source for news, or Facebook for their official source for news or dialogue. Even things like weather, and you cannot trust them because they are inherently fallible. They have biases. These algorithms are programmed by human beings that make mistakes all the time. None of these things are going to be here in perpetuity, and we shouldn't rely on them to feed our brains with the knowledge and nutrition that they need to survive in this particular polemical culture in which we're living right now.
Well said. They all do provide services, and they all are something that we can benefit from. But if you rely on them entirely, if you rely on Facebook to get all your news, you're not going to be informed, and a lot of people will suffer as a result.
No doubt. I mean, I completely agree. I mean, all of these are cautionary tales.
All right, we are out of time. It's the spring equinox, so we're going out with a suitable bit of music for that. Write to us, oth@2600.com. We'll be happy to read your email, maybe even on the air. We'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions. Follow us, Hacker Radio Show, on Twitter, or listen to any one of our radio shows at www.2600.com/offthehook. We'll see you next week. Good night.